Part A, Are Not Befallen. The shopkeeper turned to the security guard and said,
"Okay, so you're in a position of authority now. You can't just go acting aggressively from speculation. You gotta start with communication and work towards confirmation. First things first."
"Neither you nor I are characters in the story I am about to tell. We can't be. We're not in Paramus, New Jersey. I've never even been there. Right now, three people sit at a table outside the mall. Two are employed there. The third is a random transient whom they found re-rolling cigarettes from the ashtrays. One of the two is mall security, the other managing partner of a cafe. They are female and male, respectively. The transient is also female, somewhere in her mid-twenties. They do not know it, but their meeting here is not random chance. Rather, it is a form of geometry. It is, of course, an accepted principle that two truly parallel lines will never intersect. They may appear, through convolutions of perspective, to do so, to overlap even. The reality is that each stretches on infinitely, ever separate and distinct. And so, these three folks are, right now, involved in the unlikely process of bringing the influence of one perfectly straight line to bear upon another. They're kind of like gravity, which nobody really understands. Everyone can feel it. Like with music, anyone can hear a melody. Many people can describe it in general terms, predicting exactly what will happen, when and how, with considerable accuracy. These attributes of gravity's effect are the foundation of modern science. Yet still, the power of attraction which governs all bodies in the material universe is known only by what it does, not what it is. So I'll be describing them, and attempting to predict the outcomes of events using the passages of their interactions like planets through the zodiac, but in reality, the truth is beyond us. Unless, of course, gravity is that quality of inexpressible truth that we call music, as differentiated from sounds. In which case, I shall be absurdly surprised to discover that there was truth in this prophecy." The transient wore no shoes, purposely. She reckoned this was part of her most necessary and appropriate homage to the native blood in her veins. That same blood which colored her cheeks quite unexpectedly when the manager of the coffee shop bumbled pretentiously to her defense. He was tall and young, at least too young to run for president, but clearly mature enough to be a congressman. The look in his eyes as he came to her defense showed more than sympathy and caffeine. It was perhaps even more than just appreciation of the exotic beauty of the girl. If one looked closely into his grin and bearing, mischievous defiance hid behind his affable propriety. One might guess that there was a backstory. He had, as the old Dusty Springfield song goes, been taken time to make time with the security guard, having known her and her ex-fiancé for most of his life. He now relished the opportunity to flirt with her, which had come about when the ex marked the fiancé. The petite, dark-haired security guard had come into Cafe Queequeg this morning. This was her daily ritual. Today, she complained of the cold, among other things.
"This uniform is going to drive me nuts. Short sleeves and polyester, ugh. In the morning, I'm so cold I get goosebumps,"
she said while watching the parking lot through the window.
"Maybe this mocha will warm you up,"
he replied softly, with a hint more depth of tone and warmth than he usually gave his patrons. He also held the cup up instead of setting it down, so that she was forced to look at him to get it. This she did with a quiet,
"Thanks."
As he reached out to set it down, he paused to begin a sentence.
"I've been thinking. We should get together for lunch after work. I think we both should get off at the same time."
She kept looking at him, feeling, as many would, the pregnancy of his offers.
"We should both get off at the same time,"
she repeated with tongue in cheek and eyebrow raised.
"Why not? Lunch at 2:30?
She finished, but he wasn't done.
"And a cigarette together at 11 to plot our curse,"
he stated, turning now to look at the next customer coming in.
"Sure, but don't get all mushy on me."
He laughed once with a closed mouth and said,
"Mushy? No, not yet. You first."
At precisely 11, she met him at the employee exit door. As they exited, He admired the crisp lines and soft appearances of her neck and ear against the sunglasses, hat, and shirt she sported as part of her uniform. As he did, she was turning her head to notice and immediately begin reprimanding the transient.
Okay, so you're in a position of authority now. You can't just go acting aggressively from speculation. You gotta start with communication and work towards confirmation. First things first,
Ishmael said, between drags on his hand-rolled cigarette. That smoke, residual vaporous evidence of paper and dried organic matter rapidly oxidizing, causing reactions in the mind and physiology of those involved, has an inverse relationship to the symbolic value of these words. But this story isn't about you and me. Both ladies were now rolling cigarettes from his pouch. Maggie had left her menthols in her locker.
I'm no good at rolling, Ish. Could you?
She was looking down at the mangled wreck of an attempted roll-up. Self-loathing tainted her face. He guessed that it was over forgetfulness and manual ineptitude. Her reluctance to admit even that little failure in planning had set off Ishmael's insecure-adar, his acute awareness of the neurotic tendencies that all people betray in their speech patterns and body language. He decided to begin pushing at the cracks in her armor.
No problem. My pleasure. Tobacco is for sharing, but please call me Ishmael.
The other girl with them snorted a little laugh. He smiled at her while rolling Maggie's smoke.
Novo,
he said, raising his eyebrows inquisitively. She smiled broadly in return, raising both for a brief fraction of a moment. Thus encouraged, he continued,
this might work for you too. I used to work for Starbucks. Used the money from stock options and credit they helped me achieve to open a coffee shop of my own, here in the mall. I call it Cafe Peacock, CQs for short.
She let out a mouthful of smoke with that sensual effort that allows rings to form.
I thought they made you sign a non-competition agreement, intellectual property and all that jazz.
She said while watching him watch the smoke ring dissipate.
Oh, they did. I waited years before making my move. When I first opened, they opened another of their stores inside the mall here, too. Rent went up the next quarter. Some folks thought it was the end of me until their new push buttons alienated half their customers. I floated away on three folks' coffin.
He responded while appreciating that she had formed another large circle of white in the still air. Their table was protected by a concrete umbrella that some practical engineer had plopped on a pole that ran down into the table. It had been here before there ever was a Starbucks outside of Seattle. He watched Maggie's mixture of fascination and uneasiness as the transient sent another small ring to sit in the larger center, like a pupil within an iris. She made a funny face and rolled and looked at her cigarette. It had gone out. These things are
hard to keep lit. And they're pretty harsh.
The transient spoke up with,
American spirits are like that. Pure tobacco, an acquired taste, none of that artificial garbage that the big boys will push on you.
She gestured at the ashtray she'd been picking leftovers from at 11.
Thanks again, Ishmael, and you too, Maggie.
The other woman sat back quizzically.
For what?
For letting me stick around.
Maggie sniffed, sat erect in her spot, and relit her smoke.
Don't thank me. He's your patron saint.
She drawled through a mouthful of white wisps. All three fell silent for a moment. Ishmael chose that moment to make the aggressive statement he'd been composing in his head throughout the dialogue, reckoning that her response to this would tell him if they had a chance at real compatibility.
Okay, so you're in a position of authority now. You can't just go acting aggressively from speculation. You gotta start with communication and work towards confirmation. First things first.
He'd never before been anything but cordially platonic with her. She was great at that. They were healthy and well-employed. On paper, they were perfect, but it was in verbal and intellectual sparring that real attraction began for him. She inhaled sharply through her nose, flaring her nostrils and causing the cheap, silver-painted plastic badge on her chest to sparkle dramatically with reflected light. Her tone and choice of words then reflected his.
Okay, so that's interesting. I'll do my job the way I'm trained, Mr. Manager.
She took another drag.
These are harsh, but I kind of like it. Look, miss, what's your name?
Barefoot Bohemian Riot Girl replied,
Elemental P, QRS TV.
Maggie rolled her eyes and made as if to stand. The girl quickly and coldly defended herself.
It really is. It's three different family names that my full-blooded Dinah mother harvested from my father's family tree.
Ishmael desperately attempted to reroute the conversation.
Dinah, Navajo, right? So sharing American spirits with you turns out to be something more than just a random act of generosity.
He said while turning meaningfully toward Maggie. She felt his drift and responded.
Okay, point taken. Ellie, can I ask you a question or two for the espresso jerk's benefit?
Sure, Margaret.
Came the transient's reply. The espresso jerk hit his chortle in a false cough, as if choking on a smoke.
Okay, so you're barefoot, heavily tattooed, wearing clothes that look like you rarely change them, and here you are re-rolling cigarette butts in an employees-only area. I speculated on seeing you that you were transient. Is that true?
Elena P. took a sip from the travel mug she carried with her everywhere, wiped her mouth with the back of her hand, and said,
If by transient you mean homeless, no. This land is my land, and if by transient you mean constantly in motion, then yes, transient. Transient? I'm half immigrant, half native. My ancestors betrayed and warred with one another, but I own all of my own flesh and time. Truth is, I prefer the term refugee and sojourner.
Maggie stubbed out her smoke and half yawned.
And your purpose here is?
The girl looked down at her dirty bare feet.
I'm walking the Appalachian Trail right now, hitched into town to go dumpster diving.
Like some dramatic lawyer on the networks, Maggie stood and pronounced,
Well, that's another on my list. Part of my job is to keep this area clear of undesirables. Barefoot hitchhiking scavengers qualify immediately. I won't call the police and trespass you, but you can't do any of those things here. I've got to get back on the clock.
With that, she began walking, then turned.
And you, Mr. Ishmael, I will see you later.
She called with a smile as she donned her shades. He sat back and looked at the girl. She was rolling up the tobacco from a couple more snipes, including the remains of Maggie's. Smiling all the while, she hummed a little ditty.
Yo-ho, yo-ho. It's a pirate's life for me.
He sang along, having caught the tune. Immediately. Since they'd met, each had been quite amused, albeit separately. Now, for the first time, they laughed together. He then said what he thought was the nicest thing you could ever say to a woman you barely knew.
I feel like buying you some shoes, Nuevo Zapatos Vanmos.
Maggie's cigarette hadn't refreshed her as she'd hoped. Not that anything was likely to have, as much as it normally would. Flirtation with Ishmael and jousting with that vagrant would normally have recharged her engines fully, like the deep breaths of a swimmer between the strokes of controlled violence that propelled her through time's waves. Today, first thing in the morning, the surf overtook her and nearly drowned her. She had gone under and been washed up on a metaphoric shore after the mad chaos. Inside, her head felt like she'd struggled against sands and currents on a battle she only won through surrender. To complete the metaphor badly, the coffee at dawn and smoke at lunch had been the compulsive paroxysms common to those who nearly drowned. Since the breakup of her long engagement, she'd been trying to reach the Mercy Shore by daily, mechanically, working the clock and sparring jaw-to-jaw with anyone who'd engage with her. Ishmael had guessed well on which buttons to push, because such is conversational conflict for Maggie, the fuel with which she oxygenated the flame with which she beat back the cold and damp of common loneliness. The rogue wave that had struck her and had doused all hint of spark, only work remained, with the exception of Ishmael's unexpected forwardness. That little bit of warmth from him perhaps began to compensate for the spattering of blood among scattered, shattered teeth that newly decorated the sidewalk and doors near the recycling bins at the maintenance entrance of the mall. When she found that, she hadn't even been in uniform yet. Before breakfast, before coffee even, a hazmat and law enforcement issue had sent her tumbling. Calling the police had been like the first underwater moment when one realizes that the tide is in control. Putting on her cheap copy of the crisp blue uniform and speaking to the real law had been surreal. The cops had been pleased. They already had the culprits in jail. The evidence she'd been assaulted by seemed important in piecing the story together. The three men in custody were in varying states of brokenness. However, like Jesus and the two guys they hung him with, only one is really important to this story. His name was Mike, but his handle is Nimrod. People only called him Mike when their purposes were official, familial, functionally formal, or unfriendly. When administrators, cops, or just generally fastidiously nosy folks insisted on knowing what his parents called him, he would respond,
"My dad calls me stupid, and my ma calls me sweetie, but they're both wrong. It's Nimrod."
The odd concentration of coincidences that make this story seem like it's worth telling all seem to involve him. For example, he and his pregnant girlfriend lived in Ishmael's garage. Above it, actually. But they paid for half of the garage as well. None of these three owned a car, but Ishmael kept this space open in case he had visitors who needed to use it. Nimrod operated a sort of political activist social club called the Info Shop out of the garage. It had one photocopier, two laptops, three printers, and a wireless router. Like the food on the Apollo rockets, it was a dehydrated anarchist's collective. Just add liquid. Here's where the synchronicity began to strain credulity. Elemental P had spent the previous night there on the garage floor. Nimrod knew her as Canarchy Girl, a notoriously elusive percussionist, puppeteer, and provocateur in the Positive Protest Posse. When he wakes from the anesthesia, he will be in a hospital bed in the basement of the county courthouse. His jaw will be wired shut. The other two will be in much worse shape. In fact, only one will still be alive. Those two will be in beds across the room, 24 feet and two walls of wrought iron bars away. Nimrod will be able to hear the flatline beep of the dead man's monitor. In his heart and head, he'll fear the sound might be creating a gravitational pull that forges parallel lines in his relationship arc with his as-yet-unborn child.
"And never the twain shall meet,"
he'll mutter Shakespeareatorially. Once upon a time, he'd use the initial Q as his name. Those two found out why he'd been saddled with the handle Nimrod while serving as a Marine in Iraq. Whether in a combat zone declared by international custom or one hidden within the paranoid obscenity of the domestic war on drugs, Nimrod was a mighty hunter and warrior. Like his namesake in Moses' syncretism of the Egyptian, Hebrew, and Sumerian histories of Babylon, Nimrod did it all with strutting pomp and circumstance before the Lord. In the name of God, as proof of the wrath of the Son of Man, Nimrod was destruction. The military had trained him to act with the ruthless efficiency of extreme prejudice. He took it all a step further by reading up on samurai. Somewhere in the philosophical cocktail of a born-again crusader samurai, he thought he'd found a real solution to the big questions. This solution led to a dishonorable discharge. In the wild rush of the hunt, he went AWOL, chasing down attackers alone when he should have stood sentry. When he returned, having dispatched three enemy insurgents, he found the other four and his party dead. They'd done well taking out three enemies, but two remained to become remains at Nimrod's discretion. He was very discreet. Then he buried his two new trophies, reconnoitered the three decoys he'd already dispatched to bury as well, and waited for relief. When they found him, 3 days later, another insurgent had joined this American's democratically, they devoted with their violence, selected pile. Found culpable in his fellow's fate for abandoning his fort, he received no benefits or hope of pension from Uncle Sam. His mental martini of martial methodologies and messianic delusions was mixed twice, shaken by PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and stirred with marijuana swizzle stick. This habit he'd picked up from the Caucasian Rastafarians, who were prominent in Pyramus peace protests. This self-described agro-redneck peace punk Rastas with mullet dreadlocks hanging down on their dirty wife beaters and Carhartt overalls were prominent members of the local dumpster diving scene. The dead man's flat line will signal the nurse, cops, and doctors. They will bring to him paper and pen on a clipboard with which to write out his statement. It will speak for itself in his inimitable style of absurdly egotistic self-awareness, writing of himself in third person in all caps.
And it pleased the Lord to guide the hunter to the marketplace of Paramus. The last crescent of the waning moon formed Diana's necklace, and the Milky Way her garment as she danced in the heavens with Orion. Nimrod found the Kaonarchy girl, a Navajo, Kokopelli, come to sing redemption to the people of Paramus, if they should care to listen. Nimrod found her beside the dumpster of Whole Food Grocery, eating organic blue corn chips while drinking lemonade. Yo-ho, he cried.
Aloha,
she replied. Gleaners, they saved food for a dozen meals and brought it to the storehouse of food, not bombs, in tribute. They clenched carrots in their fists and held them high. The Navajo woman was weary from 1,000 barefoot miles. He bid her recline on a cushion and went back to the gleaning on his bicycle. The Lord led Nimrod to a test of strength and character. Two servants of destruction, possessed by demons released by methamphetamines, lay ambush with wooden 2x4 planks. The hunter became the hunted. One blow to the mouth they delivered unsuspecting, knocking the warrior from his ride. A dozen others each double attempted, but Nimrod was untouchable. Dancing as a lion amongst jackals came some 100 yards. He navigated the crossroads beneath flashing amber and crimson lights. In the lot across the street where he had his face crushed with one fell blindside, he finally disarmed one of the two curs who doggedly nipped at his heels. Grasping the plank he'd ripped free, Nimrod delivered to each a blow to the neck in fluid motion of three turns, striking first the other plank on the fingers of his would-be assailant, knocking it free, then each opponent once to the place where neck met jaw. His blows had such force that each collapsed utterly. Taking up both planks, the hunter raised them to the sky in cruciform. When Nimrod knelt, placed the cross on the ground between the vanquished, and wept.
Finishing, he wept again. A sheet now lay over the face of one of his assailants, the one with the mangled hand. He would never know that he had lost the use of his fingers, at least not in this flesh. Though unabashedly biblical in his life, Nimrod was among the unchurched. In fact, he saw himself as a force of social erosion, sent to bring down false churches and idolatry through dissemination of propaganda and collective reasoning. He lay back and thought about the teeth he lost, chuckled a gurgling chuckle, and sang through his shattered mouth,
Yo-ho-ho, we are the invisible pirates. It is better to stand alone than to stand with the enemy.
John Evan Bonhoeff awoke in the den of his father's McMansion. The book he'd fallen asleep reading, Herman Melville's Moby Dick, lay open, face on his lap, half crumpled between his legs. His glasses lay on the table beside the chair. Before trying to find the spot where he'd drifted off in the book, he put on the spectacles. They corrected only for distance, but he felt more awake than with them on. There it was, the Pequot at sea, Starbuck commanding Queequeg and Ishmael, brooding Ahab, colluding with the tortured elements of his soul to hunt down and destroy the ghosts, real and imagined, of his past. The book was a gift from the cafe owner, who bore its protagonist's name. To John, it marked an important passage in their relationship. That dynamic was far more important than the passage of the text he now marked with a flyer that had come with it for an event this afternoon. He looked at the rumpled paperback in his hand, then slapped it against his palm. Between the flyer and the fiction, he should be able to knock off a third, perhaps half, of the items on the list of things to do today, now taking form in his barely conscious near-alpha state mind. After starting coffee brewing in the kitchen, he began his standard 6-item list on a piece of paper. It would remain with him in a shirt pocket all day. Yesterday's list had been written on the back of the paper of the bookmarking flyer. Number 1. Hallelujah! Number 1 never changed, yet for one simple word it held, for him, a long and varied stream of meanings. They would change throughout the course of the day, though the syntax, text, and punctuation stayed the same. Number 2. W-O-R-D, word, wept, W-E-P-T. Number 2 had been the same for some 18 months as he worked on a high-end book for technicians running the A-B side of Christian worship services. He was stuck on some point, some
consciously caught in a crux that kept him from completing the careful construct. Number three, Ishmael. Three was frequently in flux, rarely, if ever, the same thing 2 days running, though often the same item appeared. Today he planned to get coffee at CQ and make a show of reading the book until Ishmael came to talk. The barista was a regular rhythm guitarist for their congregation's contemporary worship band. Not the world's best guitarist, but the secret line of credit behind the state-of-the-art equipment the Paramus Vineyard Christian Fellowship used, a most important relationship to cultivate. Number four, James, chapter 1, verse 27, food not bombs. Item 4 was always headed James chapter 1, verse 27, the injunction of the brother of Yeshua ben Yosef that true religion was to visit the widowed and the fatherless. Ishmael knew that number 4 on the daily list. He'd given him the flyer for Food Not Bombs as a means of outreach facilitation. Apparently, this hippie sideshow soup kitchen in the park looked to Ish like a fertile mission field for the 127 fundamentals. Number 5, read the Bible. Number 5 never changed either. It may seem self-explanatory, but it has a deeper meaning. He found himself always wanting to read Scripture. It interfered with most of his other tasks. He wrote this item each day so that he could cross it out and thus, by transference, place an arbitrary and acceptable limit on how he buried his nose in the Jehovah's little instruction manual for life on earth. It was to him, as intoxicants are for some others, an addiction. He attempted to manage his endless attraction to deific diction by making lists of other things he must first complete before he got biblical. The theory rarely regulated his bibliodolatrous obsession. 6. Find someone to kiss. This last one was why he hadn't finished a checklist in nearly 3 years. As a healthy, reasonable, and well-spoken young American, he was mystified by the lack of play in his game. He owned his own home, had paid his college debt down by half, and was actively involved as the sound engineer at his church. For such a man to go 33 months without a date was a typical travesty of the modern scene. Girls yearning for nice guys tend to share the same jerks as the good time girls did. He had come to kid himself recently that the passing of the 32nd month would mysteriously herald the thaw, that the ice formed over the stagnant pools of his hormones would crack and dissolve as his passions sprang vernally to life in the transition from month 32 months of monkishness to 33, preferably with a girl who liked Jesus too. His 6-item 12-word list completed, John poured the coffee and pulled his cell phone from his pants pocket. He was nearly dead for having spent the night in his pants, leaving a small bruise on his thigh where he'd rolled over on it instead of on his father's electric bill. It would have to be plugged in before he could do anything else. It was already near the end of the lunch hour. He normally wasn't so nocturnal. The night had passed with intense cross-referencing of Jonah, Ahab, and their respective marine animals. Dawn had come homerically, rosy fingers tickling him to sleep while he read. He looked at his reflection in the refrigerator's chrome. This look of unshaven dishevelment was not a decent public face, so he factored in a shower to his already busy schedule. Canarchy Girl let herself back into the info shop through the second floor apartment window by climbing a tree, dropping onto the roof, and swinging down the drainpipe to cling to the ledge of the window, which she had spotted as being slightly ajar from the ground.
Yo-ho, yo!
Herself as she broke into Nimrod's bathroom. The nice yuppie this morning had known the tune as well, in a present and singable sort of way. She hadn't asked him about it. If she had, he'd have mentioned the pirate of Paramus, Nimrod, and she wouldn't have had to break in. She presumed that he'd picked it up from the new pirate movie, where the plays his own dad. She'd been recently indoctrinated by Nimrod into his circle of invisible pirates.
The theme song was...
Sail the seas of knowledge. body of his little pirates. They come to redeem the time. It's wasted on hatred.
By shining.